desperate. The Babylonian armies had overrun the border fortresses of Judea, breached the walls of Jerusalem. Nabopolassar's troops had razed the citadel and set fire to the temple. The king of Judea, the nobility, were yoked and in chain and on their way into captivity. The prophet Jeremiah was walking the bitter exile's road to sanctuary in Egypt. And then the Bible tells us in that
magnificent portion I read to you this morning, but somehow on this bitter, grieving journey, Jeremiah had the sense that God spoke to him, and in that vision, God transformed the defeat into a rebirth. There was greenness again in the land. The people were free again on the land. The vineyards were replanted. The fields were tall with corn. Matza chein bamidbar am shrire harev. The people that are left of the sword have found grace in the wilderness. Now, I thought very often during our visit to Israel this summer of this particular portion of this verse in our Bible. For truly, the survivors of the bitter centuries, the few who outlived the Holocaust, have built a graceful civilization in what was but yesterday a wilderness. 50 years ago, in the lifetime of many of you, less than 200,000 people squatted in Near Eastern poverty in the wilderness that was then the Mandate of Palestine. Oh, here and there, there was a dot of greenery where a small Jewish settlement had been founded. But the hills were barren, the fields were too stony to be cultivated, the rivers were brackish, the ancient irrigation systems were useless. Tel Aviv was a sand dune. Haifa, a sleepy, squalid port. And in Jerusalem, in the sacred city, there were a few thousand of the pious living in near poverty among the ancient ruins. In Israel, those who returned 50 years ago, they suffered in the pale of the settlement. They had been unsettled by the pogroms in Russia and by the revolution. They were threatened by the renaissance of anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic feeling. No one would have believed that these people could be the pioneers and the rebuilders. And they were to suffer greater anguish yet, and still in Israel today, just 50 years later, you find the men and women who still bear the stencil of their concentration camp numbers on their inner forearm, playing the violin in the symphony orchestra, performing delicate operations in the hospitals, wheeling their grandchildren into the parks, enjoying the seacoast and the free air of their free country. It's important for a visitor to Israel to remember this near history. Because if you are Jewish, if you've been close to the rebirth of Israel, you've in a sense been emotionally too close to it. You have read so much and seen so much that you take the achievement for granted. And you forget that in the last 50 years, the forced march of Israel from poverty into a modern state is one of the great miracles of our century. Of the 118 member nations of the United Nations today, more than 80 have a standard of living lower than that of the Israeli. 25 years ago, not 50, but 25 years ago, learned international commissions were telling us learnedly that the entire mandate of Palestine, one-third again as large as the present state of Israel, could support a population of only 750,000 people. Today there are 2.25 million of people in Israel enjoying almost all the amenities of modern civilization. Israel is one of the few backward nations which has emerged into the 20th century, which has conquered illiteracy and disease and epidemic, which has built a wholesome culture, and which has brought its people up into the light of a new age. And this we must remember. And we must remember that also that during these 50 years of challenge and of confusion and of crisis, Israel has not gone back, as have almost all other emerging nations, on its tradition of being a democratic state. No strong man has emerged, no group demanding class privileges. Israel has maintained faithfully the democratic tradition alone among all the emerging states of our world. We have reason to be proud of this achievement and reason to remember it. The problems of Israel, and Israelis love to discuss these problems, are real, and they are serious, but they are not critical. They are problems which must be confronted and challenges which must be met. And we must remember the backdrop, what has been achieved, and remember what can be achieved by a people united, purposeful, and willful. So when I speak to you this morning of several of the problem areas of Israeli life, keep in mind what was, and what has been achieved, and what this people will achieve. I speak not in any sense of danger, of any feeling that the Israeli economy or the Israeli society lacks the will or the wherewithal or the skills to adapt to the needs of the 20th century. They have adapted. They have come of age. But we Jews are a critical people. We like to know our problems, to lay them before us so that we can find solutions. And it is in that spirit that I should like to lay two of the major problems of modern Israel before you. The first is the financial or economic problem. Israel today is suffering from a slowdown. Some call it a recession. There are soft places in the economy. For 8 years, there was almost no unemployment in Israel. This year, some 35,000 Israelis are out of work. And the labor minister, Alon, indicates that this number may top out by the first of the year at about 51,000. The cost of living is inching up. Cost of food, and the cost of housing. There's very little uncommitted capital, investment capital in Israel, and interest rates are at an all-time high. Now, a visitor to Israel cannot see this economic slowdown. There are no bread lines. There are no laborers picketing in the streets. There is no economic political confusion as such. Occasionally, you will see, as you can see on the beachfront at Herzliya, between the luxury hotels, a 14-story cement skeleton meant to be a new hotel in which no work has been carried on in the past 18 months. But the signs are few. You know this, that your bills are higher than they were on your last trip. The cost of living has gone up. And if you look carefully, you'll notice that fewer apartments are being built in and around the cities. Beyond that, you must turn to the newspapers to read the details, the graphs, and the charts of Israel's economic problems. And when you turn to the papers, you'll discover that for all of their partisanship, they deal with the problems of Israel in depth and realistically, with a care and a concern that American newspapers reserve for the lurid or for a murder trial. And you will find a discussion of Israel's economic situation when you go to visit the Israeli. For one of the great and unexpected dividends of a trip to Israel is that it renews for you your love of conversation, of contact with people. In America, we deal in banalities, in small talk, banter, cocktail conversation. God forbid that we should talk of the serious things. In Israel, your host will gently but forthrightly and firmly turn the conversation of the American away from whom you met once 20 years ago in his hometown, and make you deal with the things which are of interest to him: Vietnam, the problems with Syria, the economy of Israel, the politics of Israel, and the like. Living in Israel, you recognize the kinds of information and the kinds of citizenship which underlie a strong democracy. You are grateful for it, and you wish it for your own country. Now, what is the problem in Israel? The financial problem. And is the Israeli economy a viable one and sound? When we began to read early in the spring of this recession, I heard some say, the Israeli economy is fundamentally unsound and artificial. The great leap forward has been brought about largely by German reparations money and by American and international credits given to backward nations. The Israeli economy lacks a productive and a distributive base sufficient to generate the capital it will require now that the reparations are over, and now that Israel no longer qualifies for these no-interest credits. Now you will see the artificiality of the Israeli economy crumble, and it will be revealed to be weak and artificial. I'm not an economist, but I spoke to many in Israel who were, and I read carefully the reports in Israel. I must confess to you that the Israelis are ultimately convinced of the soundness and the wholesomeness and the strength of their economy. Why then this slowdown? You ask an Israeli that, and he'll ask you why you're suffering from inflation and a slowdown in your own American economy. When he's beyond jibing at the visitor from abroad who is so inquisitive, he will speak to you of two reasons. The first, the sudden and abrupt end of in-migration. The second, 10 years of consumer economy, which the Israelis gorged themselves on luxury and consumer items, sudden end of the reparations money, of the inflow of capital, the need to return the economic investment picture to basic industry, to send the capital now into developing the plants and the machines which will allow Israel to compete in the international market. The Israeli will tell you that in 1964, immigration into Israel ran at a rate of about 50,000 a year. In 1965, immigration ran at about 25,000 a year. This year, it is running at something less than 8,000 a year. Now, those industries in Israel which depended upon servicing the in-migrant, especially the construction industry, were deeply hurt. Construction in Israel is down some 44.5% from a year ago. This is an industry which requires manual labor, involves a large number of people, and a great deal of the unemployment belongs in this one industrial area. Now, the Israelis have been building their nation for some 50 years. They have sacrificed, and they have pioneered, they have bled. They have lifted the rocks and paved the roads and sowed the fields and manned the defenses and did all that was required to be done for a nation. Blood, sweat, and tears. And after the second defeat of the Arab nations in 1956, the Israelis decided collectively that they needed to pamper themselves a bit. They wanted something of the good things of life for which they had sacrificed. And over the last 10 years, they have enjoyed and allowed themselves to buy many of the things which make life easier for a person. In 1956, less than 4% of the Israelis owned a car. That number has now doubled. In 1956, less than one Israeli family in 10 had a labor-saving device, a vacuum cleaner, a refrigerator, or the like. Today, one family in 4 enjoys, quote, such a luxury, unquote. In 1956, 60% of the Israelis lived in quarters where there were more than two people per room. counting living room and dining room and kitchen, all the rooms of the apartment. That number has now been reduced to less than 35%. People came into the immigration camps, the Ma'abarot. As quickly as possible, they moved into a city apartment, and from the city apartment, if they could, into larger and more generous quarters. Israelis are even buying television sets, even though there is no television broadcasting company in Israel. If you live in one of the border areas or one of the high areas and you have a very high antenna, you can pick up Cairo or Beirut or Amman. And so you see the strange sight of Israelis listening to American cowboy pictures with Arab subtitles and discussing it in Hebrew. Now this consumer splurge, which was not discouraged by the government, is modest indeed by our standards of affluence. And as long as a great deal of foreign capital was coming into Israel, it could be handled and managed within the terms of Israeli growth. In each of the last 18 years, the Israelis have managed to increase the gross national product more than the increase in their population. But with the end of these monies, Israel could no longer have both butter and luxuries, the staples and the indulgences. And so in the last 5 months or so, a series of economic reforms have been announced for the Israeli economy. The wages of the worker in Israel are pegged to the cost of living. They rise automatically when the cost of living index increases. That rise has been halved. The rate of rise has been halved for the next 2 years. As the costs of living went up, as Israelis bought the things which they wanted to buy and forced prices up, wages went up automatically. As wages went up automatically, the cost of the finished product went up. And often the Israeli finished product could no longer compete in the international market. Now, for a while, in certain industries, the Israeli government subsidized goods that were shipped to markets abroad. But as wages rose more and more, it became impossible to maintain the subsidies at a level sufficient to compete in the open market. And Israel now must lower the costs of production by freezing wages and by increasing the effectiveness and the efficiency of its plant and machine. And this, too, in the last 10 years, the government has been unwilling to pursue with the speed and the determination it must. For it is a socialist government. It depends upon the unions and upon the workers for its support. And it was unwilling to take the political risk of temporary unemployment in this field or in that, in this industry or in that, during periods of technical and technological changeover. But now the government realizes that it must do two things. It must tax capital gains more rigidly than even it does at the moment. It must prevent further investment in plants which produce for the consumer in Israel. And it must give subsidies to plants which are trying to retool to compete effectively in the international market. These plans have been announced. Some say that they are insufficient. But Israelis will have to tighten their belt even more. I do not know. But I know this from my conversations with Israelis. If they are prepared, again, to undertake whatever sacrifices are necessary to keep their country strong. And as one Israeli reminded me, don't overpaint the dangers that beset our financial picture. When we have 50,000 unemployed in Israel, and this is the first time in 10 years we've had any unemployed in Israel, we've only reached that level of unemployment which you have had in the United States for the last 20 years. And if you worry about the imbalance of our imports and exports, the unfavorable balance of trade, in terms of statistics, our unfavorable balance is less than 20% of yours. Don't overpaint the picture. And I believe that there is truth in this. Some 3 weeks ago, the finance minister, Mr. Sapir, was in New York City speaking to a convention of international monetary experts and bankers. And he said very forthrightly and candidly, the present weakness in the Israeli economy comes because we are in an interregnum condition, changing over from that period of our history where we received great aid from abroad to that period in our history where we must generate our own capital for investment purposes. We recognize that we have serious problems, but we have, and I quote, the will and the plant and the skills and the manpower and the determination to move our economy ahead. And in 1966, this, the most dangerous year for the Israeli economy in the last 18, the Israelis have somehow managed, even this year, to raise the gross national product of their nation faster than the birth rate of the nation itself. That's the first of the problems which confronts Israel today and of which Israelis will speak to you and speak to you at length. Perhaps a more dangerous problem is in the field of education. Israel enjoyed this great leap forward largely because it was able to draw on a highly trained and intellectually sophisticated citizenship. Immigrant to Israel, trained in Europe, was among the most highly trained and highly skilled persons in our world. All of a sudden and unexpectedly, the millennial attachment of our tradition to Torah, to the love of learning, to the cultivation of the mind, paid an extraordinary dollars and cents dividend. But this European immigration has grown older. These people are now in their 60s and in their 70s, many of them. The newer immigration waves have come from North Africa, from the Near East, and many of the people who have come have been semi-literate or even totally illiterate. They have lacked the reserves of skills. And Israel is in the position now of having to train its own, have an educational system which can replace those magnificent minds which were given to Israel by Mr. Hitler, replace them by magnificent minds trained in the Israeli public school systems. And unfortunately, as yet, in quality, in curriculum, teachers, structure, the Israeli school system is inadequate to the challenge. Now, Israel can say with pride that it is one of three nations in the world, one of every three nations in the world, which demands at least an eighth grade education of its people and makes such an education free and mandatory. But that's not enough. For a little nation which cannot depend upon the mining of natural resources, upon heavy industry, upon manual labor, it must depend upon highly sophisticated and technical skills, engineers and research people and professors, those who can develop the resources of the mind and of modern technology. The facts are serious. One, 20% of all Israeli children do not go beyond the eighth grade in schooling. 50% of those who receive an education beyond the eighth grade go to vocational or trade schools. They're taught electronics or carpentry or some skill of the like. Of those who go beyond high school, whether they go beyond the eighth grade, whether they go to a vocational school or to an academic school, 50% never graduate. The Israelis do not have enough schools. They've never been able to make, as we do in America, 12 years of education mandatory. Would cost too much. They lack the teachers. Now the Israelis recognize as well as we do the great lacks in this educational system. They've been moving heaven and earth to provide scholarships to pay for the tuition of students beyond the eighth grade. They're able to pay today for the tuition of some 45% of these students and a partial grant of some 35% more. With American monies, they are busy building 64 new high schools in Israel. But this is only a beginning. There is a teacher shortage. The classes are average out at 40 to a class. Schools can be open only from morning till 1 o'clock, a half day. The child is free the rest of the day. Many who teach in the classes are, in our terms, unprepared for their responsibility. There must be someone in the class, and so they are put there. And there is another compounding problem, and that is the existence of competing school systems. During the period of the mandate, the British government, which was very parsimonious, encouraged the various political parties and religious groups to develop their own school systems. They would pay for them and manage them and teach their own ideologies through these systems. In 1948, when the state was established, it lacked the funds to take these school systems over. And so religious parties in Israel and the religious bloc in Israel continues to run their own school systems. And these compete bitterly for the educational dollar. Education is simply not stretched broadly enough in Israel to meet the needs of a modern state. Too many stop too soon. The Israelis trying to expand its high school program, the Israelis are trying to expand their college program. Where once there was only the Hebrew University and the Technion, the Western Reserve in the case of Israel. Today there are three Hebrew universities, two branches, large branches being built in Haifa and Beersheba, as well as a central campus in Jerusalem. And there is a large metropolitan university being built in Tel Aviv, which may ultimately have some 20 to 25,000 students. Israel is determined to move heaven and earth to educate its citizenry. And Israel, I predict, will turn to us more and more for the investment capital and human resource for monies to aid in the building of these schools, which is its most critical, in my mind, need of the moment. But the problem is not only one of money and of numbers. The problem is one of what we call today compensatory education. There is one thing the Israeli fears, is that his country will become what he calls a Levantine state. By a Levantine state, he means a state not unlike those of all of his neighbors, passive, politically roiling, semi-literate, with a stratified class society, with a few who govern, and a large lumpen proletariat, a large mass who are governed. And why does he fear this? Because the last million who have come to Israel are Jews who have come without the cultural traditions of Europe. They have come from the back hills of Yemen and of Kurdistan, from the farming villages of Morocco and Algeria. Fine people, good people, bright people, but hardly literate people. They want the best for their children, but the best means to give them the simple skills of a goat's herd, or a smithy, or a farm boy. My little daughter, age 4 and a half, fell in love with a 17-year-old Israeli by the name of Chaim. Now, Chaim couldn't speak Hebrew, or rather, he spoke as bad a Hebrew as Sarah did. And Chaim could hardly speak English. His language was a mixture of French and Arabic. He came from Algeria. He had come 18 months before. He could print an illiterate French. He could not write in Arabic. He would be taught a year from then when he went into the army. He would be taught to read and to write Hebrew. Where was he? In a trade school. For our hotel was a trade school for personnel in the hotel and service field. He was learning to be a busboy and to be a waiter. Any of the qualities of person, the amiability and the graciousness and the interest in human beings which qualified him quite adequately in this field. Sarah had good taste. But Israel cannot exist on waiters and busboys. Israel's future depends upon taking these people and giving them every advantage and using every capacity with which they are born and training them for the industrial and for the engineering age, which is our age. 60% of the elementary school children in Israel are from the homes of Oriental Jewish parents. And that percentage will increase. Because the Occidental Jew, the Western Jew, the European Jew has an average of 2.8 children per family. The Oriental Jew, who already numbers one half of the population, has a birth rate of 5.6 children per family. Now the Israelis have already created a counterpart to our Operation Head Start. There are 22,000 3- and 4-year-olds in preschool training. The number is to be doubled in 12 months and it needs to be doubled again. The Israelis are speaking of a preschool training program which will reach down to the 2-year-olds, take them early out of their homes and surround them with Western culture. 1 out of every 3 schools in Israel is open from dawn to dusk. The schools in the poorer areas. There they offer library and tutorial and study hall and medical care and dental care and guidance and counseling and the like. The Israelis are determined to prevent a stratification of their society between the European and the Asiatic, between the literate and the semi-literate, between the highly skilled and the inadequately skilled. And the Israelis are paying today 10 times more of their national budget than we are paying for this type of compensatory education. Some Israelis are grumbling. Some middle-class Israelis of European origin are complaining that their children are not getting their fair share of their tax dollar. Israel, the Israeli government recognizes that the future of Israel depends upon a homogeneous society, between a society all of whose members are sufficiently educated. And the Israeli government is moving heaven and earth, not only to have 1 school in 3 open from dawn to dusk, but 2 out of every 3, so that the entire Oriental population can be so treated. Not only to develop a program of Head Start for the 3- and 4-year-olds, but to develop a going ahead program for these children at all levels of their schooling system. And in the reports which have come out of these programs, great achievement has been noticed. The learning abilities, the intellectual quotient of these Oriental Jewish children in the 3- and 4-year-old age group has been increased by 15, 20, and 25%. When they've been able to create after-school programs for the junior high levels, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, they found that they can double and triple the number who qualify through examinations for academic high schools. Education is the Achilles heel of Israel. If the Israelis succeed in creating a first-rate educational system, and they are determined to succeed, they will succeed in maintaining that high level of Western 20th century culture which exists in Israel today. There are more art museums and archaeological museums in Israel than of all of Asia. There are more bookstores in Tel Aviv than in all of Africa. The Israeli is rightfully proud of the level of culture which he now enjoys. But he knows that he must now train a new generation to appreciate what he had been trained into 20 and 25 years ago. And that is his challenge. And in a sense, that is our challenge. For that is the help that Israel will require of us in the near future. Monies for buildings. Those of us who are teachers, those of us who are administrators, a year or two of our time to help them to develop and to organize and to mend these classes. Israel requires, as it has always required, the strength of the diaspora, the strength of the Jewish communities throughout the world. The will is there. The vision is there. The basic democratic philosophy is there. Israel is determined to be the first nation in the history of the world which manages to create a society without visible class distinctions. We have them in America. We have them in England. Israel is determined to do without them. We pray that she will succeed. And we recognize that this success will not come cheaply, nor easily, nor tomorrow. That we require the investment of time, skill, and of capital. And we must be prepared to aid in that investment for the future of Israel, in the sense the dignity of Israel depends upon it. The Israelis are a confident breed. You sense a certain brashness in the youth, but it's not the same brashness you find here, which cloaks an uncertainty, which cloaks the mixed up quality of the adolescent. The young Israeli has a sense that he is part of one of the great pioneering experiments of mankind. He is proud of what has been accomplished. He is proud to be a part of one of the great social experiments of our age. This gives him a certain broad-shoulderedness, gives him a certain sense of being important, sometimes becomes self-importance. But you leave Israel proud of these young people, proud of their parents, confident that they will succeed in their dreams. 50 years ago, who would have believed that the pestilential swamps would become fertile fields, or the sand dunes along the coast would become great cities? And 50 years from now, perhaps they will say, who would have believed that what the Israelis stated then about a classless society, a society of educated men, a democratic society in the purest sense of that word, who would have believed that this society could be achieved? Israel is a thrill for the soul. It warms the cockles of your hearts. If you haven't been, go. I'm not a tourist bureau, but go. It'll be good for you. Prepare yourself when you go. Prepare yourself to read and to understand, to meet, to get to know. You'll come back humble, recognizing that your people are sacrificing and struggling and achieving. And to a certain sense, you and I are simply living and enjoying and accepting. And the struggle and the sacrifice and the achievement are clear to us here in our own nation. We have great social problems, not unlike the problems of Israel. Great economic problems, not unlike the problems of Israel. Perhaps we are, in a strange way, not only closer to Israel for our visit, but more energetic in our own citizenship, closer to our own nation. Amen.